a constitutional amendment to jail more people without bail, controversy over a National Guard bill, plus a statewide energy plan, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 27th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, Indiana Senate Republicans voted to change the state constitution to allow judges to withhold bail entirely for a lot more people. The current constitution requires judges to offer bail except when a person is charged with murder or treason. A proposed constitutional amendment would expand that to allow bail to be withheld for any crime as long as the person is a substantial risk to the public. Courtney Curtis represents Indiana prosecutors. She says judges should have the freedom to make individual decisions about individual defendants.
If you limit it to a certain number of crimes, then you run the risk of not including folks that you'd want to include and including some folks that you'd rather not.
Indiana Public Defender Counsel's Bernice Corley says the proposed expansion would widen existing disparities in the system. She says many people who can't afford an attorney don't have a lawyer at their initial hearing.
Frightening to think of what Erica said. There is no nexus between charge level and losing your freedom.
Even if the legislature approves the amendment this year, lawmakers will have to prove it again in 2025 or 2026 before it goes on the ballot for voters to approve. Is this a good change to the Indiana Constitution? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, should we give judges more flexibility in withholding bail?
Judges have all the flexibility they need right now. I mean, they can look at the seriousness of the offense, the likelihood of fleeing, all of those issues, and they can set the bail wherever they want. They don't need any more. This is one of these bills that Republicans periodically come up with to show that they're really tough on crime. And, you know, we're going to spend a lot of money on a constitutional amendment that really doesn't do anything that judges can't do already. So, no, it's not a good idea.
So if it does, but if it doesn't do anything, then what's the harm in changing the Constitution?
That's a great idea. You know, we're all in favor of gardening. Let's put that in the Constitution. It doesn't do any harm.
I mean, we almost did. We did the hunt to right to
soft fish.
Hopefully we'll get the tenderloins. But back to bail. One, it's a pretty blunt standard that bail is optional except for murder and treason, which doesn't really take into Courtney Curtis's point is right. If you just start listing, the alternative is you start listing out violent crimes. I'm a serial rapist. Okay, well, now that's on the list. Okay, well, this thing happened in Carroll County. This thing happened in Allen County. What about that? Well, let's go back and amend the statute and we'll add those crimes because we let somebody out and they went and raped or murdered somebody else and escalated the crime. So changing the standard from this kind of blunt instrument to judicial flexibility that allows them to take into account the criteria of the case at the local level in conjunction with prosecutors, I think is the right direction to go.
John, there's some synergy here. You talked about this on this week's episode of Indiana Lawmakers. See, I got it in ahead
you
of you.
You plugged it before me. So, that doesn't preclude a plug for me
to get
as well.
So,
We are far from the only state that would have this if we do change the Constitution. So again, is there a lot of harm in giving judges flexibility?
Some states, you're right, are moving this direction, but other states have actually gone the opposite way. You look at, for instance, New Jersey, which a few years ago, as a state, really tried to get rid of cash bail in almost all circumstances. If you have a violent offense, you're held for maybe 48 hours, but short of that, you get a summons. And early data, and perhaps it's too early to say how it's working, these things unfold over time, but suggestion is that people are still appearing in court at roughly the same rate. Meanwhile, the jail populations have gone down 35%, which is a good news for folks. And other states, New Mexico and a few others, have done this as well. And actually, even Indiana, if you look at Criminal Rule 26, which after 4 years of study and pilot programs, the Indiana Supreme Court issued this order in 2020, I believe, which, again, was designed to sort of add some structure and encouragement to make sure that those who aren't a threat or a flight risk are not held unnecessarily. And to a certain extent, you know, I don't know if this is a counter, certainly to a few high-profile instances that get a lot of attention when they occur. Sadly, they do occur from time to time, or if it's Rule 26 or all of the above, the sort of the notion of get tough on crime. But, you know, to the extent that this is derailed, if you're an opponent, it has to happen in the General Assembly. By the time this gets on a ballot, the way these things are worded in other states, they essentially say, do you think judges should keep bad people who are dangerous behind bars?
Yeah,
and I'm being only somewhat hyperbolic. And I don't think the public is going to think that that's not a necessarily good idea.
The idea, though, of we see states across the country moving away from bail because increasingly it becomes an issue of, well, if you're rich, you don't have to stay in prison, and if you're not, you don't. You do. Even if Indiana wanted to move that direction, this amendment wouldn't preclude them from doing it. It doesn't say you have to offer bail. It just says you can't withhold bail for a longer list of, pretty much any crime as long as they are a substantial risk to the public. But some Republicans voted against this on the floor, and I want to talk about Sue Glick's part of it, which is if there's a chance that this is derailed, is it from the perspective of how do you define substantial risk to the public?
Yeah, and that was her point, was that it was very vague, and that as a citizen, and I think this is even in the Constitution, like you're supposed to be able to tell from a law or a constitutional amendment what that means for you. And this is so subjective to each judge that you wouldn't really know if you would be able to get bail for X, you know. So that's the confusion about vagueness there. And it doesn't sound like, though, they're really interested in clearing that up. I mean, what I found ironic was a statement by several Republicans saying, well, that's what the courts are for. They'll interpret it, which is not what you generally hear on other items.
Yeah. You know, Ronnie Pohl pointed out on Lawmakers This Week, I won't go into the full plug since you already did it kindly, but he pointed out, he's one of the people who voted against it, Senator from Chesterton. He said, you know, what about associations? You could say, well, this person might pose a risk because he's a known member of X gang or Y gang. Now, he said affiliation, he used the example of NRA membership or gun ownership, which sort of turns that argument on its head and strikes at the notion of an affiliation that Republicans might see as less sinister, but the public might see as with an individual
with
enthusiasm
right
about guns. So that's, he raises an interesting question, one that I think.
But you also have to consider that we do still have the presumption of innocence, okay? And you have crimes that people can be accused of that are heinous, and judges stand for election too. And if they, you know, if they have the right to deny bail, you know, they're going to have some political pressure on them too. And that you've got to at least consider the possibility that people who are arrested are not guilty. And if you hold them for that period of time, they don't get those days back in their life.
That's a limited government argument, right? That's the kind of a little bit of the conflict.
And
here,
we
right?
saw some Republicans mm-hmm. vote against this for those exact reasons, which is, whoa, we're depriving people of liberty without defining what substantial risk means,
right.
Without, you know, you don't have to prove your case the way you do, you know, to convict someone. You do, though, it does require, correct me if I'm wrong, a higher, it's not just, maybe they did it, maybe it, there is a level of proof required at that hearing in order to withhold bail entirely,
you know,
under the current system.
You know, it just depends on what it is and how substantial it is and whether it's going to get into evidence or not. You know, I mean, there are lots of questions on that can't be resolved.
And I'm not sure every defendant or every suspect has legal representation at
that.
Some counties, I think, do afford that opportunity, but
others,
you're essentially there.
They just don't have the resources.
By yourself.
Right? Yeah. All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question, and this week's question is, should Indiana change its constitution to allow more people to be held without bail? A, yes, or B, no. Last week, we asked you who you thought should be the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate in 2024. 7% say Jim Banks, 58% say former Governor Mitch Daniels, 35% say someone else. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana House lawmakers overwhelmingly voted to pass a bill this week that would make it easier to court-martial and punish National Guard troops. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Adam Yahya Reyes reports debate over whether part of the bill violates service members' due process rights will likely follow it in the Senate.
Many opposing this bill agree with part of it, Some lawmakers and groups, like the American Legion Indiana chapter, have issues with the provision taking away troops' right to request a court-martial instead of dealing with administrative punishments for lower-level offenses. Lisa Wilkin is vice president of the Indiana Veterans Support Council Board.
Taking the ability to demand a court-martial away gives commanders unfettered ability to give out administrative punishment that can be appealed, but that's after the fact.
The bill's author, Representative Chris Jeter, argues the administrative system is chock full of due process.
You have the right to consult with a lawyer, have witnesses, have someone in your unit speak for you, appeal the judgment. A lot more, I think, than any other employer probably would give.
Jeter also notes the bill would prohibit confinement as an option for these administrative punishments.
Mike O'Brien, beyond just this bill, there's been issues of controversy over the last few years over some military and veterans bills, with the major veterans groups in the state even fracturing over them. We saw that fracture first happen, I think, a year or two ago, and now it's happened again with the American Legion splitting from what they call the Big Four veterans groups. Is this a troubling trend at the Statehouse?
I think it's a consistent theme. I think we have the large veterans organizations, and then we have ancillary groups that some peel off for a single issue, cannabis or healthcare, or some access to healthcare or other issues. So I don't think that's necessarily like troubling or a trend. I mean, I didn't serve in the National Guard. The author of this bill served in the Navy as a Naval Reserve JAG officer, who authored the bill, and his co-authors are two National Guard veterans. So I got, and this bill brings us in line to what other state National Guards are how they're handling this as an administrative matter, where appropriate, in a court-martial, where else they think it's appropriate.
I've never served in the military. My dad did. But I don't understand why you would bar this from happening, I guess. I guess that's it's why make this change in legislation? Why bar them from requesting a court-martial for low-level offenses? That's what I struggle with, is why do this at all?
In the military, like any organization like this, you have a tension between due process and efficiency, all right? And you can't have a court-martial if somebody's convened or somebody's required to stay in their barracks for the weekend, okay? So some of these lower level that don't involve incarceration at all have to be handled by the chain of command. There's still an appeals process if you've got an abusive commander, which can happen. But basically, these low-level offenses should be handled internally, and you've got to have discipline. I mean, when people talk about military justice, I'm not sure that's not an oxymoron. You know, with the chain of command, you surrender certain rights when you're in the military. I don't mean they can lock you up indefinitely or anything else, but you're a subject to orders from a superior officer, and you've got to follow them, and they've got to have that chain of command for discipline. So it makes perfect sense to do that. The change to have somebody besides the governor have to convene a court-martial should have been done a long time ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, there is more to this specific bill, too, when it comes to court-martials. And we heard some stuff there's a Senate version of this bill, too, where court-martials don't seem to be happening at the National Guard.
Yeah, apparently the governor hasn't called one in years and years and years. And what wasn't made clear in the hearing is why not. I mean, they admitted they had at least four sexual assault cases that should have gone through a court-martial instead of this administrative process. But they never explained, like, are they asking the governor to call a court-martial and he's not? Like, I'm not sure where the breakdown is occurring, and that part was not clear at all.
Going back to my original question, John, this is not the first time we've seen veterans groups making a lot of noise at the Statehouse over something a bill they don't like. But, as Mike also pointed out, it does seem to be the smaller, as he put it, ancillary groups. So, are some of these controversies that have popped up much ado about nothing?
I don't know the issue well enough to say that they're much ado about nothing. I think it's not surprising, perhaps, that you do see differences of opinion within groups, because, yes, there is the commonality that people take an oath and they wear a uniform and serve our nation and protect us from all enemies, foreign and domestic. But it's a large group that's not monolithic. And you look at age group, you know, you have a lot of times people who were, my father, a World War II veteran, who maybe view things differently from somebody who either didn't serve in combat or
was a Vietnam veteran.
I mean, and again, age is not the only
I think you increasingly see a lot of difference between the way veterans were treated after they came home from Vietnam versus the way they came home from the Gulf
War or conflict. And I think we learned as a nation some lessons collectively about how not to treat veterans who were fulfilling their obligation to serve their nation, maybe in an unpopular war, but it shouldn't be taken out on them. So I'm not surprised that there are differences. I'm sure people who have a much better handle on this view this as a necessity, and maybe for reasons that Ann suggests, there is some efficiency value to this.
4 years ago, Indiana formed a task force to come up with a statewide energy plan as the country transitions to more renewable energy and new technologies. Now, a state house bill aims to do just that. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports it passed unanimously out of committee this week.
The bill cuts the amount of power utilities can buy from the grid during peak demand in half. That means they'd have to show they can generate about 85% of their energy themselves or from contracts with other companies. The bill's author, Republican Representative Ed Soliday, says grid operators are concerned the U.S. could face more rolling blackouts as utilities rely more on the grid.
They said everyone is buying and no one is selling.
The Indiana Energy Association says utilities generate or contract out most of their power anyway, and that the bill wouldn't change their plans to transition to more renewable energy. The bill also says the state agency that oversees utilities has to consider five things in most of its decisions: reliability, affordability, resiliency, stability, and environmental sustainability.
John Schwanes, at long last, is this a statewide energy plan that puts Indiana on a good path?
No.
Oh,
no.
That was a remarkable bit of
ventriloquism. Yes. I think it's a sound policy. We've studied this as a state for a long time, several sessions. The task force, the group, has looked at various aspects of this. And no one can really argue, I don't think, and this is why we saw it come out on a unanimous vote from committee, that if you look at any of those five criteria, there's not a bad one in there. We want to have reliable energy. We want it to be affordable.
Redundant.
But the fact of the matter is, it's probably, if there's a flaw, and maybe there won't be. Maybe this is aspirational. We can all, as a state, move toward this goal. But, I mean, these are terms that are subject to different interpretations, much as we talked about with risk to the public in our first topic today.
Definitely
what is affordability? In fact, we saw the Citizens Action Coalition in committee saying, well, we need to define further. What does that mean? Is it 6% of gross pay, which is, I guess, a standard often used for excessive utility payments? Is it? Because you could say reliability to one person is not to another. Now, there is some tangible, there is a number in here, about 85%. That utilities would have to either generate themselves or have contracts for. In other words, they'd be able to summon that energy at a moment's notice.
Yeah,
and that's something that Ed Soliday, who's been a driver in this, has been very important to him about reliability, having seen what's happened with brownouts in Texas.
Yeah, not relying
and
on the grid for
exactly,
too much of
exactly.
Energy. And that was my question to you, which is this going to do that much in terms of the future?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think they've made a start on this plan, and they're going for sort of overarching goals. And I think, yeah, it passed unanimously because it's not that specific, right? But, you know, I can see where a lot of people are going to want more specifics, and it doesn't go far enough. And I think that will be the fight for the rest of the session.
Yeah, I'm as they say, old enough to remember when Mike Pence promised this in his 2012 campaign, and Eric Holcomb promised it in his 2016 campaign, and now we finally got, looks like we're going to get, after a four-year study. After a four-year study, is this enough?
No, it's not enough. And, it really is, I think, designed to make sure that our reliance on fossil fuels continues, because what they've done is they appear to be doing something towards sustainability and alternative sources of energy, but they're not really doing anything. And in fact, at that one bill that was there to allow people to buy into regenerated electricity gets voted down. So this is their attempt to protect big utilities and fossil fuels and still put a little fig leaf to say we're really trying to do something about this, but we don't want to do very much.
When we think about our energy future as a state, is this a little too broad
Do we need a little more specificity to some of this?
I think what's interesting over this four-year process is how the market's changed and gone towards renewable energy. Yeah. Where, you know, the high-profile, like most controversial proposals that have been considered in the General Assembly early in this process were overt protections of fossil fuels, where, you know, the large energy companies were coming back and going, hang on, we're converting
right.
to natural gas, we're converting to solar. We do still have work to do on how you open the door to develop those renewable projects. We don't have statewide standards. You know, a local BZA or a county council can block a large-scale, you know, renewable project.
Or small-scale ones, too.
Or small-scale ones.
You're not allowed to sell your excess to the grid. Yeah,
there's limitations on that. We don't have a Texas brownout network. That is a unique closed system that we don't have. We can go buy wholesale power if we need it. Tension's the right word between moving too fast into renewable energy and having a reliable source of energy has always been the standard, even as the market's changed.
It's like the four-quarter offense. We'll slow it down as long as we can.
The market's going to move faster than the legislature.
You want a shot clock is what you want, Ann.
Yeah.
I do.
The Indiana Black Legislative Caucus says its focus in 2023 is closing the achievement gap, helping reduce inequities in education, housing, and health care.
One of the IBLC's bills, a longtime priority, is also on the governor's agenda this year, automatically enrolling students in the state's 21st Century Scholars Program. The program provides full tuition to Indiana colleges and universities for middle and low-income students. But IBLC Chair Earl Harris says the problem is you have to enroll in 7th or 8th grade.
A lot of times, the parent doesn't know about it, the child doesn't know about it, and by the time we have the conversation, it's too late.
Harris says while the caucus helps represent Black Hoosiers, their agenda isn't meant to serve only one group.
Teacher support, financial support, public help, all of this helps everyone. Doesn't matter if you're Black, white, Latino, Republican, Democrat, Libertarian.
Other caucus priorities include scholarships for Black and Hispanic students pursuing healthcare careers and ending discrimination in housing appraisals.
Nikki Kelly, why has automatic enrollment in 21st Century Scholars been such a hard sell for Republicans for so long?
I don't know. And to be honest, I don't think I've heard it as much as I have all of a sudden. I mean,
governor puts it on his agenda, that's
certainly right. But I mean, it wasn't like they've been trying to do this for 10 years and they've been blocking it again and again and again. I think it's sort of a new try at it. And while they're at it, they should also look at, like, what's magical about 7th grade that you have to sign on? Like, why can't you sign up in 9th grade? Yeah. You know, there's lots of ways they could do that. But obviously, if more kids sign up, then you're paying for their college. And so that has a financial tag there at the end, too.
I will say this, you know, in terms of that, it's hard to say, well, here's going to be the financial impact. Because if when you're enrolling kids in 7th and 8th grade, you have no idea how many kids are going to need to take advantage of this. It's possible that some kids will go out of the eligibility guidelines
or move out of state or decide not to go to college
at all. And so it's hard to come up with this is how much this bill is going to cost. Is that maybe some of the reason that I think it's been mostly an amendment the last few years from Democrats?
I'm sure the lack of certainty is troubling to some people. But as a state, couldn't we agree that if there's anything we could put our money in, it's ensuring a quality education for people who want to get that education and then become a contributing member in some fashion of society. I would think that even if, in the unlikely event that 100% of people maintain their eligibility by staying away from, you know, drugs and their grades stayed high, we should celebrate it, even if it means dipping into some other fund that we hadn't anticipated.
And in terms of return on investment, which is possible, or which is popular, this program, the students who use this program do really well, right?
Yeah, there's worse problems to have than 100% of low-income kids who meet the criteria get automatically enrolled in the 21st Century Scholar program.
Yeah, exactly.
Is this the year for it, finally?
I think so. And by the way, it's the Evan Bay 21st Century Scholars Program. It was a great idea initially, and there's no reason not to expand it. The goals of the last several Republican governors have been to increase the number of college graduates, and we're going the wrong way. This would be one thing that could help.
Maybe it's about political strategy, though. If the supporters of this went with, say, expanding vouchers from K through 12 to K through 16, you might be onto something.
That's probably right, yes. Although the voucher program or the charter school program does not have the success rate of the 21st Century Scholars Program,
I'm being facetious.
Well, there's been a larger discussion about college going and post-secondary attainment, and I think, again, that might be why this is...
with mandatory FAFSA, mandatory sign-up for financial aid for kids, more light on the options.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think we're closer to it than we've ever been before, and I think this might
be good.
Yeah, this might be the one that finally gets it over the hill, but we'll see, because
especially given that
everything's always in the... Ultimately, it's up to budget than anything else, and...
We talk so much about workforce and the economy, and do we have when we were looking, strutting our stuff for companies that might want to move here, they often say, what does your workforce look like? And to be able to say, here we have a program that has proven incredibly successful, that would seem to me to be
quite
a selling point.
Yeah. All right. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS video app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.